Accession number 30284, Reel 1.
Roy Nesbitt, Reel 1. Roy, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in a place called South Woodford, which is fairly near London, on the 24th of June 1921. I was the second son in the family. I had an elder brother, and then I had two younger brothers who were twins, so there were four of us in the family. My father worked in the Bank of England, and he was fairly well placed in one sense. It was a fairly secure job, and we had a normal sort of middle class upbringing, I would call it. We all went to school. My elder brother went to a public school, I went to a grammar school, my two younger brothers went to a grammar school. And we all coped reasonably well. We had a matriculation qualifications.
What was South Woodford like as an area to grow up in?
Well, it was somewhere on the edge of the London conurbation. But we didn't stay there very long because my father had the policy of always moving house to the edge of Epping Forest. Now, as children, we used to run about a lot in the forest. And we had a fairly large garden, too, and a dog, and we were quite active as children. We also all rode bicycles a lot, too, and so I suppose we were fairly healthy. We played sports. I played cricket to some extent at school, and, of course, rugby. And I played other sports, I suppose. I was quite good at cross-country running. I played fives, which is rather unusual, which later led to squash. I played in fives court. That was my best game, I think. I was quite agile. There was one handicap I had as a child, and that was that I was left-handed. And in those days, I was only about five at elementary school, and I was top of the class, and an inspector, I can remember her name, Mrs. Pettit, came in and said, "What's that boy doing writing with his wrong hand?" And they made me change to my right hand, and I went right down from the top of the class to the bottom of the class, and also developed something of a squint, which had to be corrected. I was also not allowed to bat left-handed on the cricket pitch. I had to bat right-handed. And this set me back scholastically for some little time, but eventually I overcame all that and my eyes came right again. But that was the one thing which irritated me and still does irritate me. It was a foolish thing to do. It isn't done nowadays, but it was done in those days. And I suffered from that handicap as a child.
Were your parents from the London area?
No. My mother was, but my father, in fact, came from Newcastle-on-Tyne. The family were a border family, and they lived at a place called Etal, which is just south of the Scottish border near Coldstream. And my grandfather was a ship's engineer of some importance. And he made a lot of money and came down to London. He duly lost it all. And what happened was that my father, who is the youngest in the family, remained with him and his wife, whereas the three elder brothers all went to South Africa, and two of them prospered there. One of them was killed in the First World War. The other two were involved in the Boer War, believe it or not, and again in the one of them in the First World War, where he rose eventually to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel and got his MC and so on.
Was that of interest to you when you were growing up?
It was indeed. The First World War interested me a great deal. It interested most of us, I suppose, in those days. But in particular, I was interested in the flying aspect, the RFC and the RAF, and I used to make models of airplanes, German and British airplanes, Sopwith Camels and Fokker D7s and all that sort of thing. And I took an intense interest in flying. Because in those days, very few people had flown at all. And I would have liked, I did have an idea that I might join the RAF anyway. But of course, the war came along, and so I did join it.
With the models, what did you make the models out of in those days?
Well, they were just bits of wood, and one had to shape them and stick them together and then paint them. But I wasn't too bad at that sort of thing. And what, I don't know what's happened to all these models. They got destroyed eventually, I suppose. But yes, I mean, Hawker Harts and Fokker D7s and Fokker triplanes and Spads and things like that. I used to make all these models and paint them and so on and so forth, and read all I could on the exploits of First World War pilots, both German and British.
What would you read that in? Would it be magazines or books or newspapers?
In little children's magazines, chiefly. I think I used to go and buy these things for a few pence and soak them up. I used to find it extremely interesting. I must say that having known something about First World War and about trench warfare, when I became almost eligible for joining the forces, I did not want to be in the trenches. I knew too much about the circumstances, and I thought the best thing to be was some heroic fighter pilot in the air than somebody sitting in all the squalor in the mud. It struck me, and also there was the attraction of flying. It's just very unusual. I mean, I had no opportunity to fly when I was a child, but when war came along, of course, I was immediately extremely interested in joining.
Were you able to visit airfields or things like that when you were a child?
Yes, there was North Weald, which was nearby, and occasionally we used to walk all the way to North Weald and see what was going on through the fence. I don't think we were ever allowed in the... but we could see the aircraft take off and land. But that was the nearest I got to flying.
And how were the sort of record-breaking pilots of the period seen amongst young boys?
I think we all thought it was stupendous. We thought it was the most interesting occupation one could ever have. It struck us that pilots were heroes. We wanted to emulate them in a childish sort of way.
Can I ask a little bit more about your education? Where did you go to school?
I went to school in Wanstead County High School, and we had a mixture of education, I suppose. Took French and Latin and maths and English, geography and so on, various sports. I was no good at Latin. I didn't like the teacher, but I did excel, might be too exaggerated the word, at English, and not too bad at French. And I was particularly good at art. My father was something of an amateur artist, and my mother was too. And I used to copy them in a way, so I think I got the highest mark ever obtained in art in our school in matriculation. But my other good subjects were French and English particularly. Geography wasn't too bad. Usual sort of matriculation subjects.
Was it the school? Was it a good mixture of sporting activities as well as academic activity?
Well, without doubt, we played quite a lot of sport. We played rugger, we played cricket, we went on a lot of cross country running. I was quite good at cross country running. I'm fairly light on my feet, and my father was something of a hill walker, and I became the same way myself. And I've always had a lot of endurance. I mean, there's no problem for me to run 5 miles on a school cross country. Even though we did have a master running behind hand who might put a cut across the legs on the cane, wouldn't be allowed to do that sort of thing now, but that's the way it was with us. With the whole school would have to go running, and the master would be behind with a cane. In those days, of course, you could get the cane. I didn't get it very often, but I don't think it really hurt very much, but it was a form of discipline which existed then, which didn't worry us at all, I might say, at the time, but does now.
At this time, obviously, the situation in Europe was changing. How aware of that situation were you at the time?
I was well aware of the situation in Europe. I used to read the newspapers avidly and follow what was going on. We knew what was happening, particularly with these pogroms and the like, and the brutality which was being exercised in Germany. We were quite well aware of it. And we realized, I think, 2 or 3 years before the war, that a war was imminent and something would happen sooner or later. There would be another great world war, as the Great War, as the first one was known. We knew that we were coming up to that. And as children, we knew that if it did come, that we'd all be either volunteers or conscripted into the services. So we had to make up our minds about what we wanted to do. And as I say, my inclination was to keep clear of the trenches and to get in the air.
You say we as children, was that a general feeling amongst most of your school friends or just your family?
Well, it certainly was well known amongst the boys I moved around with. We knew that this would happen. Or it was highly likely that it would happen. And I was determined to volunteer as soon as it did happen. By this time I had left school, and my father, as I say, worked in the Bank of England, and I was pushed into Lloyd's Bank, and it was intended that I should go into the Bank of England and follow his footsteps, which was considered an extremely good job in those days, but I didn't like banking, and I had to study banking examinations and did pass one or two of them, but in order to get into the Bank of England I had to pass part one of Institute of Bankers examinations, and I think I passed three subjects and was working on the other two. Obviously this was in the evenings, and I found the subject matter very boring, I must confess. Although, of course, had I eventually gone into the Bank of England, it would have been regarded as an extremely good and secure job, and one of, well, reasonably high distinction, I suppose, but I wasn't attracted by it at all.
Had you initially had to start out at Lloyd's Bank, though? Was that how you couldn't have gone straight into the Bank of England?
Yes, to go into the Bank of England, I had to be 18 years old, and I wasn't, I was 17 years old. So as an interim measure, my father got me into the bank of into Lloyd's Bank, and I was employed in Fenchurch Street in London, travelling up there on the train every day and coming back again. I found it uninteresting. I didn't like it at all, and I didn't particularly like the people I was working with either. I made no friends of them at all. They didn't seem the type that I wanted to mix with very much.
Why was that?
Well, I was just a junior clerk and bullied, and not bullied exactly, but the lowest of the low. And, you know, to get anywhere in the bank, you had to pass these examinations before you got up to managerial standard. And I was too junior, I suppose. I just liked it. I wanted a more adventurous life.
Have you any memories of the Munich crisis at all in 1938?
Yes, of course. We were fully aware of all that. In some detail, I followed the... we all followed the boys, these events at school quite carefully. We weren't... I mean, this was, in effect, a grammar school. It wasn't called a grammar school, but the same. I think it is a grammar school now, but, we were of a reasonable standard of education and well aware of current events. At school, anyway, we did take current events. So we knew what was going on. And we also went to the cinema, and the news was on, and we could see the events in the news intervals quite vividly. And so we could see all these Germans marching about and giving swastika bands everywhere and do their Heil Hitler salutes and so on. It was everywhere, in the newspapers and in the cinema. You could not be unaware of it, unless you were very stupid.
And was there any thought of what had happened at Munich, obviously with Neville Chamberlain returning and thinking it was peace in our time? Was that what people generally thought, or did they think...
No, I think we all thought this was a lot of nonsense, that the poor old chap was doing the best he could, trying to avoid another war. But we knew perfectly well that the German attitude was such that they were going to create a war sooner or later, and we would be involved in it.
Throughout the sort of summer of 1939, were you aware of a more sort of intense period in Europe?
I was not only aware of it, I was prepared for it. And what happened was this, that when Chamberlain came on the radio, on the wireless as we used to call it, and he said, you know, war, we're now at war with Germany, the air raid sirens went off, and we all had to wait until the all clear went. As soon as the all clear went, I telephoned a friend of mine called Dennis Folger, who was at school with me, and said, are you on? And he said, yes. I said, well, get on your bike and come round here. So he came round to my house. At that time, we lived in Woodford Green. And we knew exactly what to do. I got on my bike. He got on his. We cycled all the way to a place called Dagenham, where we knew there was a recruitment centre. And we signed on as under-training pilots for the RAF. This was within hours of the declaration of war. We cycled home. If I remember rightly, it happened on a weekend, maybe on a Sunday. I'm not absolutely sure about that. But anyway, we came home, and I told my parents what we'd done. And they were a bit surprised, but and thought it was a bit of a joke, I think, and thought nothing of it. But what happened was, I went back to work, excuse me, and I got a letter saying I had to report at RAF Uxbridge, and told the people at the bank I was going to do this. Went home, told my parents that I had to report at RAF Uxbridge. They didn't take it too seriously, but off I went, and was examined physically and mentally, quite exhaustively. You didn't need any particular physical attributes other than having nothing wrong with you. Your eyesight had to be okay. You had to do certain press-ups and things like that, I think. And you were generally asked about your medical record and your scholastic record. And then this happened at Uxbridge, and I was signed on. I was attested immediately.
You sound like you had made preparations for it. What had you done prior to the outbreak of war? Had you found out where you needed to go to initially sign on and that sort of detail?
I'd anticipated all that and got ready for it. As soon as war was declared, I knew exactly what to do.
And how long was it between you doing that initial signing on at Dagenham until the letter came for you to have your...
Oh, three or four days later the letter came to go to RAF Uxbridge. And I think I was given a travel warrant to go there. went in this place, I can remember walking away, and as I walked away, I was passing a barracks, and the chaps in that was singing, and I stood outside listening to it, and they were singing a rather crude version of Bless Them All, and I realised I'd found my spiritual home at that stage, and I really wanted to join. But what happened was that I was given a uniform and sent home, and it was an old RFC uniform. It sort of buttoned up to the neck. Anyway, I was wearing this and came home. And my mother was utterly shocked when I opened the door. She opened the door and saw me there in uniform. And because I thought that she'd be pleased, but she wasn't. I mean, she remembered my father's brother who was killed in the First World War, her own brother who'd had his leg blown off at the Somme, and she knew with four boys that, well, you know, something might happen to them. My eldest brother was already in the Territorial Army, and obviously, as soon as war was declared, he was called up. So I was next on line. But it didn't happen quite that way. And a cough, is what I mean. Okay? It didn't happen quite that way, because I was told to go home and wait, and expecting to be called up to go to flying training. But I was at home for until the end of the year, looking up everything I possibly could in the way of manuals and so on, learning all I could about the RAF and about flying. My father bought certain, I suppose, Air Ministry pamphlets for me, and I learnt all those as best I could. But we sat there pining away, wanting to get up and start flying training.
Had there been any sort of noticeable changes in lifestyle on the outbreak of war? I'm thinking of things like the blackout and issue of gas masks, that sort of thing. Had that all taken place?
Yes, we all had gas masks and little funny things we used to carry about. And there were blackout curtains and all that sort of thing. But of course it was a period of phony war, nothing seemed to happen. The troops went to the Western Front. There was no activity, only very minor activities on the front. There was no real fighting that went on. There was a certain amount of reconnaissance going on, air reconnaissance, I think, but not very much. It was a phony war. We all wondered when it was going to really start.
Had there been an anticipation that the Germans might launch air raids? Because you mentioned the air raid siren going on the day that war was declared. But had there been an anticipation that the Germans might launch air
raids? Oh, yes. In fact, what happened was that my elder brother, who worked with a firm of building contractors, he was training to be an engineer, managed to get a shelter built in the back garden. We had the shelter built. It wasn't an Anderson shelter. It was a wooden construction underground and earth heaped on top. And it was a properly built shelter. So we were prepared in that sense. But of course there were no air raids, so we didn't use it. But it was there.
Had rationing...
Yes, rationing had started, obviously. But it wasn't very severe, as far as I remember, at that stage.
Was it a strange atmosphere in that four-year period?
Well, things seemed a bit flat. I mean, I suppose we really wanted to get going. We wanted to get to elementary flying training school and start learning how to fly. That was the attraction as far as we were concerned. But it didn't happen. We were sort of frustrated, kicking our heels, not working, sitting at home, wondering what to do, doing the best we could. I'm talking about this friend of mine and myself, learning all we possibly could, discussing the matter, but there was nothing we could do except hang about and wait to be called.
How many of your other friends had gone off to join, say, the army or the navy?
I think a large number of them did. I think from... The point was that if you volunteered, you could elect to go into that branch of service which you wanted to join. If you waited until you were 20 years old, you would be conscripted and you would be sent to whatever branch of service they required, which meant possibly you'd be in the trenches, which I didn't fancy at all.
You mentioned that your father had got you RAF manuals and manuals to find out a little bit more about the Air Force. How had he taken to you enlisting?
I think he was resigned to it. He obviously didn't like it. He had been in the First World War, but he'd only joined the army at the end of the war. I'm not quite sure why. And then when he did so, he wasn't sent to the Western Front. He had some sort of clerical attribute which they wanted. So they immediately made him a sergeant and sent him to Woolwich Arsenal, where he did some sort of clerical work. So he didn't take an active part in the war. But on the other hand, his brothers did. And his, as I say, his next eldest brother was killed. He was killed in the gas attack at Ypres, the Second Battle of Ypres. By that time, he had emigrated to Canada, and they made him a sergeant major, a colour sergeant. And he was in the 1st Canadian Division, I think, and went over to the attack, and they were pretty well wiped out at Ypres. His body was never found.
And the manuals that you were reading, what type of information were you gleaning from those?
Well, fairly dry sort of information. There was a certain amount, I think I might even have some of those manuals left now. There was a certain amount one could learn on meteorology and the like, and on the characteristics of flying aircraft. I think we learnt something about how to fly Hawker Furies and the things like that, how to sit and, you know, how to handle the controls, something about the engines. We had all, you know, we did have some basic information, but no direct instruction at all. Only what we could glean from these manuals and from other magazines we could buy.
How did that period come to an end for you? What happened?
Well, what happened was that by about Christmas time, I was told I had to report to Downing College in Cambridge. And that was called Number One Initial Training Wing. And I was given, I can't quite remember how this happened, but we were given the rank of leading aircraftman. I think I'd been an aircraftman second class before, and given a proper uniform and great coats and kit bags and all the other stuff that went with it. Huzifs, that's all these little bits of pieces you had, and had to report to Downing College, Cambridge, where it was an ecclesiastical college, and half of it remained for the undergraduates and half was taken over by the RAF Initial Training Wing.